Global Sports. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Voices from the Edge is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Yes, come ride your bike and dance the night away on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m. as we celebrate Prince's birthday with a mobile bicycle dance party. Roll around Portland with Diablo as we rock Pedalpalooza, dropping the Prince jams all night long, stopping to dance along the way. Again, that's Prince's birthday celebration on Friday, June 7th at 8 p.m., beginning at his mural on 42nd and Prescott. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Good morning.
Get up, stand up.
This is Rochelle Dixon with voices from and along with me, I have Lani Kali, and she's going to be chatting with us today about food justice, and a little later on, we'll have a call-in. We're expecting a call-in from another guest. His name is Edward Hill, so he'll be calling us shortly, but we're going to start out, first of all, with Lani Hill. So I thank you for being present with us today. This is a live show, so you can call into KBOO right now. Again, I'm here with Lani Kali, who is one of the co-founders and originators of the Lentz International Market, Farmers Market, and she's currently doing some work with the Selwood Moreland Market. So I want to welcome her today. Welcome, Lani. How are you this morning?
Hi, good morning.
How are you?
I am really, really excited to be here.
Oh, good. I'm so glad that you're excited to be here. And I tell you, I'm really excited to have this conversation. I want to say that this conversation is something that's on my mind all the time. And so I really appreciate you being here, and Edward, who's going to tune in a little bit later. And also, I want to, because we're at the top of the hour here, just take a moment to acknowledge that we are indeed on stolen land, and this is the traditional land of the indigenous people, including the Multnomah, Malala, Chinook, Tukwila, and other bands of indigenous people. So, Lani, we're going to talk food justice, and I know what food justice means to me and why it's important. So I'm going to not share my definition just now, but I am going to share why it's important to me. And the reason it's so important to me is I think it's the only cause among the environmental causes that touches everyone. It's an environmental cause, it's a civil rights cause, it's a labor cause. So when I talk about food justice, I'm talking about the land, I'm talking about the labor, and I'm talking about the people, and even the animals. This touches climate change, it touches your health, and so for me, it kind of just consolidates all of the things that I'm concerned about, most concerned about, into this one area, and makes it easier to have these conversations, which seem really varied and unconnected, but are actually very, very connected. So for you, let's first hear a little bit about your background, and then I want to hear something about why food justice is connected to you.
Sure. I grew up in an agricultural area in Southern Oregon and moved to San Diego and have been an activist in all types of social justice. And then here in Portland, I sort of came back to working with food because I'm also a chef. And I came back to working with food and farmers markets because I noticed the same thing that you noticed, that it really did touch on all of the things I cared about, including labor rights and immigrant rights. And I just wanted to see, I wanted to live my values. I wanted to say, okay, so this is really, really important to me. How is it that I can contribute in a positive way to this system that seems very, very broken? So I started working with farmers and farmers markets, and I see that as sort of the, it is as close to an equalizer as we can get with small farms and small food producers and communities. And when you were touching on values and sort of what connects everybody back to the food systems, one of the things that really mattered to me was family togetherness. And it seems to me like, you know, in a world for me anyway, that people seem really to be separating off into clusters and being very disparate. Food is the great uniter, and sitting around a table with your family really brings back so much of what we're missing in our big world. So that's sort of how I came back to this.
Well, Lanny, that you almost just kind of stole my thunder right there, because your story is not dissimilar to my own story. So I am the first generation off the farm and the second generation off the reservation. When I say that to most folks and they see me, they go, wow, okay, how does this happen? Well, it happens because I come from a society and a place where agriculture was it. My family has been a part of an agrarian society for as long as anyone can remember.
Sure.
So obviously that played a huge role in my mother's life. Now, for myself, I did not grow up on a farm. I was not born on a farm. That absence of a connection to a land was very painful to me as I learned about the connection that my family had, because we still felt connected to the land even though we were removed from it. So that was a very painful experience for me to have growing up. And so I became very interested very young in planting and taking care of the land, and my mother encouraged this, and so I took classes. I think when I was 11, that was it for me. I brought home like 32 tomato plants, and I was just sold on farming in general. And we maintained a pretty good garden with a pear tree, an apple tree. We had another tree in there, blackberry bushes, and then Brussels sprouts, and all the things that you can think of that you might want to eat for a nice dinner. And so it was very evident to me that food connected people in my family as we sat around and talked at the table, and things got solved at the table, and things even got argued about at the table.
Sure.
And we nourished ourselves, and then we formed community. And there are certain meals that are still very, very communal. The one that springs to mind for my community is gumbo. If you say that you are making gumbo, you have friends immediately. People you didn't even know were your friends become your friends. So I found that it was a very communal experience, and that just sold me on food, period, when I was a child. So I'm also a caterer, okay? But as I got older, I began to realize the inadequacies with our food justice systems. It didn't take me actually very long to figure out that there were problems in our food justice system, in our food system, rather, that it was unjust. That also happened about 11 when I started cooking and found out through a cookbook that there was actually enough food in the world to feed everyone. And I thought, what do you mean there's enough food to feed everyone? There clearly isn't enough food in the world to feed everyone. And so I began to think about those things, and it led me to where I am today, talking about urban farming, talking about climate chaos and the intersectionality of those things, talking about land, talking about the labor, the immigrant labor especially, agricultural labor, and payment, the loss of land for Indigenous people, African American people, and just, you know, individuals in the United States across the board. So what does this have to do with the city of Portland, progressive city of Portland? I have some thoughts on that, but Lanny, what are your thoughts? How does this fit in? Because we think of food justice as maybe being something like a little hipster, but at the same time rooted in maybe rural communities. Mm. What does it mean to be working for food justice in a city?
Yeah. So I think a important piece here is to not pretend like we have invented this wheel. Certainly agricultural communities have been gathering together to exchange food for as long as there has been food and people growing food. I think that here in Portland, we do a great job having multiple farmers markets and lots of ways for small farmers to sell their food. However, I think what has unfortunately happened is a vision that places like farmers markets and people who do small specialty farming are doing that for the elite who can afford that. And so I think a lot of times people don't see locally well-grown, sustainable food and meats and eggs as something that is available to them unless they are in the upper echelons of income. So here in Portland, we've done a great job having farmers markets. We have done a negative and not so great job making sure that everybody can access the food at both farmers markets and CSAs, like community supported agricultures, which is, of course, where folks put up a certain amount of money and then continue to get farm food for the rest of the year. And that has traditionally not been available for people who, for instance, use SNAP or the Oregon card.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's great to hear you talk about food justice in the city and specifically how it relates to being somewhat elitist. When we think of Portland being a progressive community and we think about the food supply, we think about, oh, there's an abundance of food and we're known as a food hub and we have food carts and we have all these wonderful breweries and wineries. Mm. And yet in certain neighborhoods, we have food deserts. So at one point, I think we had approximately 27 food deserts just in East County. I lived in East County for 7 years. Mm. And for those of you that don't know the definition of a food desert, it is, there are a couple different definitions, but they all center around access to fresh food within essentially walking distance. So we're talking about a half a mile or potentially a couple of miles. And what this means is if you don't have transportation and you don't, if you use a public transportation system or if you're reliant on, say, a child, a son or a daughter to take you driving if you don't drive anymore, that you're not having access to those fresh fruits and vegetables. And this causes a very disparate outcome in things like health. So we're talking more diabetes, more high blood pressure, those things. Also, in communities where there aren't access to fresh fruits and vegetables, you find that children perform poorly in school, that there's a correlation between what children are eating and what they're able to achieve in school. So these are definitely city issues. I think Portland has every one of those issues, especially among Black and brown children and disabled children in the Portland public school system. We are failing them at every turn. I don't think that's a surprise here. And so we are live today, and I want to give you that number to call in. It's 503-231-8032. And if you call in now, we'll take your call, and we'll be taking your calls all throughout the show because I am here. I'm sorry, I'm going to back up. It's 503-231-8187. 8187. So call in that number, and we will take your call, answer your questions. Again, I'm here with Lanny Kiley, who was one of the co-founders of the Lentz Farmers market, international market. And she's also currently working with the Selwood Moreland market at this moment. We're also going to take a call from Edward Hill, who's done a lot of work around food justice and work with the TILF, Alliance Immigrant and Refugee Training Program, worked at Growing Power, managed the first Black Small Farm Conference at Oregon State University. So, Lanny, tell me about Lent's Food International Market, because we've been talking about disparate impact in the city with food. And if I think about some of the spaces that haven't had good access to food, Lent springs to mind.
Sure. Yes. So in 2002, when I moved to Portland, I moved to Lent's. And Lent's was a lovely neighborhood with a lot of very close folks who lived out there who were really very organized. And we were collected together to do a buying club that used to be called the Lent's Food Group. And at one point, it was told to us that there was going to be a big investment in the Lent's neighborhood from PDC, what was now Prosper Portland, used to be called PDC. And we were really excited about that. And so we instantly went to every single thing we could do to give our input about these changes. And one of the things that our neighbors wanted, probably more than most things, was we were really excited to get the Max, but we were mostly excited to get a healthy grocery store, or sort of any grocery store. We had one grocery store on sort of the very outskirts of Lent's, and then sort of no access to a regular grocery store. And so we were really hoping that we would be able to encourage the city to encourage a grocery store. In the end, it ended up that that was not something that was the outcome of those, even though we tried so hard. So it ended up being a plan for a farmer's market.
Well, that's great. I'm going to ask you to pause there just a moment, because we have a caller on the line, I think. Oh, we have Edward Hill. Wonderful. So Edward Hill is on the line. And Edward, good morning. Can you hear me, Edward?
I'm Edie.
Oh, it looks like it's Edie, not Edward. So Edward, we'll probably call in a moment. So Edie, you have a question for us today.
Well, I just want to say that there's some things we can do about food justice, too. For example, Franklin High School in the early 19-teens was awarded the Ag High of the West of Mississippi because the children bought 18 acres to grow seed on and were feeding the community with that, in their own community. And now Franklin High School has signs up saying you're not allowed to bring in your sack lunch. You know, you have to buy the USDA food or go off campus and buy overpriced, you know, food that most students at Franklin cannot afford. It's not healthy for them. If we go back to Franklin having a foods program, like a home ec, and we have the community gardens and the food there, and we have children working on their own food carts, we are making it part of, and we can do it to our grade school, middle school, high school, that people grow food, they produce food, and it's healthy. And we talk about indigenous and sustainable and organic and just food. And also, if we just make all these spaces that are open be accessible for gardening, and we mandate that instead of putting so much money into police, we put money into open spaces for our refugee camps between our earthquakes and everything, that we are growing food and we have flat spaces for our tents and we're going to be eating throughout the city, not just in rich neighborhoods having parks, in rich neighborhoods having food. People's Food Co-op was working hard, and we voted to not get the owner's, you know, payback dividend but instead to invest in having a Lentz organic food co-op that is fair trade, not free trade, and that was really supporting local gardening with the growing gardens. And we can do that again.
Ed, that definitely sounds like a plan. I want to give Lanny a chance to respond to that because you have some wonderful ideas there. So thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate Lanny. So we had this call from Ed. She talked about a lot of things, especially about growing food in the Portland Public School System.
Yes.
And teaching students to grow food and prepare food. What are your thoughts on some of the things that she said?
Sure. I think Edie is right on. I think that it's so great that we do have some schools that have garden programs. My daughter's school does in the Brentwood-Darlington neighborhood. She goes to Woodmere, and they have a growing program there and also an after-school sun program there and also a food pantry there. So I think that there are some schools that are doing this really well, and then there are some schools that could really use some help in this regard. I think anytime you teach people to grow their own food, you empower them to not just have food to eat and food to maybe trade, but also empower them to eat in the way that their ancestors ate, or possibly to eat in the way of their culture. In a place where sometimes those foods aren't available, which going back a little bit to the idea of Lentz Farmers Market, there was this sort of idea that the neighborhood was full of all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds, and how was it that those people could attend a farmers market and could see foods that they're familiar with versus things that might be sort of very specific in grocery stores that they're not familiar with.
Perfect. And Lanny, I want to take a pause here to just announce that, of course, we are live. The number to call in is 503-231-8187 to get your question answered. And right now we have another guest who's going to tell us a little bit about his background, his thoughts around food justice and equity. Edward Hill, you're on the line now. How are you, Edward?
Good morning. I'm good. Hey, Boo, what's up?
What's up?
Yes. No, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you being on. So, Edward, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to do some of this work.
Let's see. It's 30 seconds to slam fest.
you can take a whole minute. You no rush here.
Background in kind of start in the Bay Area with environmental justice work, and a lot of my food work came out of environmental justice and working in the Bay Area and communities in the early 90s were taking on some ideas from some of the like social justice people, Ella Baker Center when Van Jones was just starting, and some chefs, some well-known food systems people were down in the Bay Area and started picking up on this thing about, you know, farm to schools and that was happening down, actually an African-American man started the farm to school program down in Florida and Southern Georgia. So there was some things happening in the early 90s that kind of influenced us in the Bay Area around food systems and looking at the food system as a way to not only partner with the Latinx community and some of the food workers and harvesters and labor in Central Valley, California. So merged with this healthy, you know, the idea about diet. So I moved from the Bay Area in 95 and moved to Olympia, Washington and started farming. Actually, one of the first people I met was African-American that went to Evergreen State College and got me into the organic farming program there. And that launched just the whole thing around, you know, like sort of my whole career. Part of my career track around making sure that, you know, not only healthy food, when we talk about food justice or, you know, like the term food deserts is sort of out now. They're doing food swamps because, you know, it's not that there isn't any food. There's a lack of
True.
Fresh and healthy access. There's a lot of chips and sodas and, you know, malt liquors and cigarettes and, you know, not that people eat cigarettes, but so that work began around for me, actually farming. So I became a farmer first, and then a researcher and an urban planner and a manager later, after I started to find my place in it, which was more technical grant writing, helping incubate businesses. So, you know, I've been, as an African-American person, identified, black identified, I did a lot of work in communities of color and African-American communities specifically to start to look at the economic opportunities for food justice. You know, it's a lot of the programs that were created, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, were run and managed by not people of color, by white women mostly, like Earth Corps or Job Corps or AmeriCorps people would come in. You have a program like Tilth Alliance or Oregon Tilth that doesn't have staff of color, and you have people coming into communities and helping to build gardens. So that was for sort of the first, you know, set of environmental justice actions, was to get healthy food to kids. And now, you know, nationally, the movement, the National Black Food Justice Alliance, the, you know, other food systems justice and food justice work that's being done is centering now around economies, or building economic power, as well as decolonizing and doing anti-racism training and anti-bias training in the food system to start to bring equity to not only how people get food, but how people grow food, how people produce food. You know, the food system is a $1 trillion industry. In our region, there's billions of dollars being moved around, yet you find most of the food justice conversation focused on getting children food, are getting people who don't have access to food, and not the business development of food. So you have, you know, programs like projects up in Cully with the large the cultural garden. Mm-hmm. You've got projects like the the Mercado project now, and food programs in the J District that are now starting to use cultural and ethnic positions and disparities to address economic development. Again, working with folks locally to try to bring that economy to scale and start to build not only health in the black community or communities of color, but also bringing wealth, right? So how do you do a health and wealth strategy around food justice?
Sure. So I want to mention that this is a live program. You are listening to KBOO Voices from the Edge. I'm Rochelle Dixon, and I'm here with Lanny Colley, who is currently with the Selwood Moreland Farmers Market, and Edward Hill, who's talking about food justice. You can give us a call at 503-231-8187. Again, it's 503-231-8187. So we're having this wonderful conversation now at 9 o'clock. It'll be Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, and she'll take a weekly look at the news that you're not supposed to know. But give us a call right now if you want to talk anything around food justice, climate chaos, anything related to economic power within communities of color, disparate treatment and disparate policies around the economics of development in neighborhoods. So Lanny was mentioning that. Edward, what do you see around Portland as a city specifically when we develop neighborhoods? There's a lot of cranes up in the air right now.
Yeah, we got, you know, you got the EcoTrust Red project is just coming online. And I've been, you know, there's a few of us that have been doing people of color, black people, native people, the folks from the Russian and Eastern European community, the Latinx community, the API folks. We did a series of conversations at the Red early, I mean, years ago, working with I think Amanda Oberon was on yesterday talking about the Red project. And, you know, one of the goals with a lot of this food infrastructure that's being built out in this city is...
So we have another call on the line. Looks like we lost Edward for just a second. Maybe that cell phone went on us, out on us. But we're going to take another call. And so, caller, Lou, you are on the air.
Hey, good topic, good program. Always helpful to talk about food justice and what would you call it, the food industrial complex.
Yeah.
ConAgra, Cargill, Nestle, Coca-Cola, et cetera. Sure. I had a couple thoughts. One, it's not exactly, this would be sort of a cross-organizing question, but I don't know if you all in Portland have heard about the protest that Saturday Market's doing. Saturday Market is roughly 300 vendors, a lot of older women vendors who've been there 30 or 40 years. But it's a protest about transit, so it's not specifically about food, although a lot of the vendors sell food at Saturday Market. The 30-second summary, you may already know this, is TriMet wants to cut 4 MAC stops downtown, including the Saturday Market stop. So Howie, who's the manager of Saturday Market, and Transit Riders Union are opposing all 4 stops getting cut. There's the 5 Multnomah County commissioners who are all women, some of whom are women of color, are specifically saying don't cut the Saturday Market stop. So that may not be specifically germane, but Saturday Market is a market, and they do sell food there. My question is kind of in terms of organizing. It sounds like the emphasis of the guests that you have are alternative, local, ethnic-based food production methods. I'm curious about 2 things. One, about boycotts. At Portland State, we were able to get Taco Bell kicked out of Portland State. Taco Bell, there was a boycott by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers for a living wage for farm workers in Florida from 4 different countries outside the U.S., which Portland State became the 9th college to kick Taco Bell off in support of that boycott. And then the boycott was settled. There's also boycotts against Nestle on environmental justice issues, and against Coca-Cola now for a national bottle bill recycling issue. I'm curious if you or your guests have thoughts about the utility of boycotts, or is it far more useful to just concentrate on alternative food production? I had one other question too, but go ahead.
Lonnie is indicating that she has an answer for that, and I'm going to take a stab at that as well. So for me, I think boycotts are useful tools at a certain place in the discussion. So I don't see kicking Nestle or Coca-Cola off of a campus as doing much to challenge the way food is distributed, the way fruit is grown, the economic development around it. At a certain point, that would be really, really important. But I think what's most important right now is building up communities so that they have the food that they need, the specific cultural foods that they need, that they're grown locally, that they have access to that fresh food, so that we're not relying on canned foods that are produced elsewhere with high sodium contents, high sugar contents. I think that is much more of a basic conversation and one that's necessary to have before we can talk about those spaces where the folks who are there are already of a certain privilege. So in the college space, you have access to different kinds of foods, whereas in some neighborhoods, the elderly or children are confined to that particular space and don't have options.
The only thought I have about that comment, and that sounds like the gist of your program as well, is that you may or may not have heard of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, but have you in Florida?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure. I'm just asking you if the people who organized the Taco Bell boycott and thought that boycott, getting 9 different colleges in the U.S. To kick Taco Bell off campus in support of a living wage, the first pay raise they had in 20 years, and the workers are from Guatemala, Mexico, El Salvador, Haiti. So it's okay if you don't know about it. I'm just curious if you had heard of that boycott specifically.
I have heard of the boycotts, not specifically organized by that group, but
sure,
by many groups.
That explains kind of your proof. The other thing I was going to ask you, and I'll let you go, is in terms of public policy, at Portland State.
Well, we're going to back up just a second. We're going to back up just a second because I think Lanny wanted to have a word. And you wanted to, the caller asked about food systems and perhaps boycotting. What are your thoughts on that subject?
Sure. I think that we are not going to be able to solve this problem with just one effort towards one thing. I think that it has to be multi-pronged and it has to be people-based. I think that when we start things corporation-based, things can feel too big. They can feel out of the hands of the everyday person. And in my experience, just worried about all kinds of problems in the world and all kinds of problems in the food system, I can find that I can use my voice and my dollar specifically myself and empower myself to do the things that I want to go towards and support. So that means for me that what I want to do is think of food as a way to, oh, we all have to spend food dollars. And unfortunately, because it's a commodity and unfortunately not a right, although it should be. I think that for me, in order to not feel disempowered by the big system, I need to be very careful where my dollars go. I like to talk to people who I buy my food from and find out what their practices are and maybe what their story is. Vote with your dollar is the answer. I think certainly there's a place for boycotts, but that can't be the only approach. We're not going to get anywhere with just one approach.
Sure, sure. So I appreciate your thoughts on that. I think my thoughts are very, very similar. And if we're boycotting something, we have to have alternatives. It's just simply not so easy to do without food, but I very much support boycotts and direct action. So the number to call in with your questions or your thoughts or your comments is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. This is Rochelle Dixon. You're listening to Voices from the Edge, and we're here with Lanny Calley, and I think Edward Hill was on the line with us just a little earlier in his call drop, so he might call back in. We might be able to hear something more from Edward. So back to Lanny. We were talking about the Lentz International Farmers Market and how that started, and how when individuals first thought of the farmers market, they conceptualized it as a place where they would be able to get specific foods around their cultural needs and in their neighborhood. So that's very important. Can you tell us about what the landscape looked like before Lentz Farmers Market came?
Sure. We had some corner markets. Specifically, we had 7-Elevens in Lentz. What we didn't have, of course, were full grocery stores. As we were having this conversation with our neighbors, I was learning that there are many of our neighbors who are used to some very regular foods that are on their table all the time in their culture, that even if they could travel outside of Lentz to a grocery store, they wouldn't even see those foods in a grocery store. So we thought, not only should we be able to bring food here, but wouldn't it be cool if the food we brought was the stuff that people in our neighborhood actually would like to see on their own table? So there was a lot of conversation, and I learned so much from my neighbors about all kinds of really different kinds of melons that people were used to, or herbs that people cooked with and would like access to. And so the goal of the farmers market was not just to bring farmers, which is awesome, but to bring farmers who specifically were growing things that the people in the neighborhood would use and could use and were part of their cultural heritage and their cultural food traditions. So that was kind of the idea of that market.
And we have a caller on the line right now. Caller, LJ. LJ, you're
good
on
morning.
The line. Good morning, LJ.
Good morning. Hi, thank you for the show. What a pertinent topic. All right, listen, it's my understanding that tons of perfectly edible food that's not cosmetically perfect gets dumped. Why is there not an outlet for this produce that gets thrown in the garbage that's not cosmetically perfect? Why isn't that marketed? Why isn't that being used?
Do you mind?
Lanny's going to answer that question for you, LJ.
Thank you
for calling in.
LJ, often the effort that it takes, and this, and you're of course talking about big production. Small farmers do not do that. So when you're talking about huge agro productions, the reason that it's not being marketed to people is because it costs more to turn it into something. For instance, if there are tomatoes and onions and peppers that are imperfect, it costs more for them to turn that into a salsa to sell to you than it does to just compost it. So So that's why, really, it's about money. It's not really about people or whether or not people need food. It's about whether or not somebody can make a commodity out of that and sell it to you. There is this trend right now toward this delivery called imperfect produce. However, imperfect produce is imperfect in itself, in that that food that imperfect produce is selling isn't always from local farmers. As a matter of fact, is almost never from local farmers. And it is pretty much the perfect produce, the imperfect part of perfect produce. So that was already sellable product. And often those that fall in between something that people are going to compost and something that people are going to sell is the imperfect space right there. And that was usually given to food banks. And so instead, somebody has made a commodity again over the food that used to go to people who had the least amount of access. So, you know, you're right that there's that little space. It's very frustrating that we throw out so much food. So, yeah, I guess that's my answer.
That's great, Lonnie. And I also want to say that back in the day, we used to process some of the food right on site. So there was less waste. Like we had Smucker's Strawberry Fields here, and there was also Smucker's Processing. So all of the food that's imperfect doesn't necessarily go to waste, but way too much of it goes to waste because of the cost of processing. We also have a call on the line right now. And so we're going to go ahead to the caller. Caller, you're with us now.
Is that me? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Hello. Good show. Important show. I missed a little bit of this while I was on hold, but there is a company locally. You can access them on the net. There's a phone number, but I don't have it, called Imperfect Produce. And they will deliver to your home at a relatively modest cost. Your choice of vegetables and fruits that are in that imperfect market. They're oversized or they're lumpy. You know, they're not rotten, they're not banged up, but they're some of the stuff that doesn't go through the regular system. They've set up in a number of large cities, and Portland is now one of them, and they seem to be a good deal. You can get organic produce, you can get regular produce, and you get to choose what you get. Some of the CSA deals where I've signed up before, you get what they have in abundance. And if they're not having a good year or if they're not very good at what they do, you get a lot of rutabagas and things like that.
Oh, okay. That's very interesting. You know, where you were on hold, caller, we were just talking about imperfect produce. And I'm going to let Lani repeat what she said. But first, I am going to add the comment that there are definitely a lot of options out there for eliminating food waste. And I wouldn't take any of them off the table. However, imperfect produce has not necessarily market itself in a very honest way. I guess I have to say honest, because I think that people think they're saving food from the trash bin, and most of the food that you're getting would have gone to a food bank or been processed into a product. So you are getting a lower value tomato, for example, than something you would see in a Fred Meyer's, but definitely most of the food that you see in an imperfect produce box would not be thrown away. I want to mention that there's a food act called the Emerson Act that allows restaurants and organizations to donate food. That's a wonderful thing. I sometimes collect food for distribution to houseless people. So I have coming up on the 31st at the Dismantle and Change Building, 14th and Killingsworth. There'll be a free community supper for our food insecure families, especially a lot of black and brown families. There is a shelter in that area. There is no food service at that shelter on MLK and Killingsworth. So we're looking to harvest food that might be thrown away, prepare that food, or if a restaurant wants to contribute, serve that food so that we can save some of that food, eliminate that waste, and also help our houseless communities. Lani, what do you think about imperfect produce? Because we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah. I think you really said what I would have said, which is of course, it is a company that was formed to make money off of food that used to be given to the lowest income folks. So, I think it's a problematic program. But what I can say about saving your own food or making the best of what it is that you have, if we're talking about growing our own food or shopping at farmers markets and you have a glut of something or something's really inexpensive, I think that it would all behoove us to go back to the beginning and do some canning and some drying and some pickling and these kinds of things that used to get people all the way through the winter. And at farmers markets this summer, at Cedar Mill Farmers Market, at St. John's Farmers Market, at Selwood Farmers Market, we'll be teaching a free canning class and a free pickling class. So look for those if any of those are in your neighborhood, and we'll show you what to do with all that extra stuff, and you'll leave with a full jar of goodness to eat in the off season.
Oh my goodness, I'm going to have to join you for that. Right now we have Edward Hill, who's back on the line joining us. I want to mention this is Voices from the Edge with Rochelle Dixon. My guest is Lanny and Edward Hill. So Lanny Kelly and Edward Hill. Edward, are you with me?
I am here.
Oh,
welcome back.
Welcome back, Edward. We've missed you. So I'm so glad that you're able to join us back again. There are a couple things that were being said after the call was dropped with you, and I think you might have heard some of it. We talked a little bit about food waste, and we talked a little bit about whether boycotts affect the food movement. What are your thoughts on some of those things?
You know, as I was listening, you know, I love food waste because it is a system. It's not just an ecological system. It's an economic system. It's a social and cultural system. So, you know, as people have come, you know, literally in the last 7-8 years, there's been, since 2012, 2013, there's been a shift. Pretty not radical, but there's been a awakening around food, especially as it relates to climate change and the impacts in our communities that are, you know, exacerbated, you know, food issues and food insecurity is exacerbated by climate change now. So as these things get worse, as like Kansas is flooded, you know, and the crops are going in late this year, I think that, you know, part of my frustration with the food movement has been it's been, you know, kind of Band-Aid approach. Let's do gardens here. Let's fix the markets here. Let's try to put oranges in a corner store here. And a lot of this work has been run and led and funded by and for organizations that do not reflect the communities that we're attempting to solve this problem with. As well as a lot of work hasn't been put into the decolonizing and pulling racism and bias and gender inequality and economic inequalities out. As we extract that out of this system, I think we can start to see this as a whole system and something that you can't like fix one part of. If we just get food to kids, then the food system's better. And it's not. It's from seed to compost, and all of those things are products, and all of those things do have an economic ability to help people who are most in need to not only have food, but to also have wages, to have better working conditions, and to help heal and restore the soil. So I think as we start to move into seeing this as a larger way to initiate change, not only in communities, but in the whole agribusiness system, like this, one of the callers was saying, you know, this is Monsanto, this is Syngenta, this is, you know, this is global movements of food and products. And there's some things that people have here that we don't need. Like, we don't need food shipped from Chile. We don't need bananas, you know, that, like, it's nice to have those things. But if we're really talking about changing the food movement, we're talking about altering how we consume food, what we grow in our region, and how we transport and share this work together.
You know, Edward, I appreciate everything you're saying, and I want to let callers know that they're listening from Voices from the Edge. If they just tuned in, they're listening to Edward Hill, who's talking about food systems and food justice, and also Landy Calley, who's also talking about food justice. So the number to call in is 503-231-8187. We're going to be on the air with you till 9, but at 9, it's going to be Press Watch. So Teresa Mitchell will take her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, we'll have the Heather McCoy Show, and Heather will talk with Lauren Wagner of Deadspin.com to talk about the Raiders signing Richie Incognito, as well as the marketing partnership between the Boston Bruins and the Barstool Sports. At 11, it'll be Between the Covers with host David Nyman, and he'll talk to Morgan Parker about the new book, Magical Negro. That sounds very interesting. So all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to make become a member, just go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate. So Edward, I want to say something that I want to ask you a question, and I think Edward's going to hurt my feelings when I ask this question, because we've had this conversation before. I am a very staunch supporter of starting where you are. So for where I am looking to launch a farmer's market and a maker's market, a farmer's market and a maker's market, where people of color specifically can come together to market their products. And also we can have younger people intern to learn about that process and perhaps go back to some of the industries that they've been cut out of. So in 1922, we had 19% of farmers that were African-American. Today, it's 0.7%. If you don't see it, it's really hard to be it. So, Edward, what do you think about that concept of starting where you are, since most initiatives, as you have just said, are not led by people of color? So every time I see an initiative and it's led by a community pushing from the outside, I'm very, very concerned. What are your thoughts?
I think as, you know, there's something, especially in this region, let's say, you know, like we're in Portland, you know, in Seattle, I did work in Seattle. I've been in the Pacific Northwest. So the majority population in urban spaces are not POCs. We know that. So the challenge is community capacity. There's a lot of interest in farming, as you know.
Yep.
And, you know, a lot of people want to farm and garden, but when you open up a farm and start farming, a lot of people want to farm. Nobody really wants to be a farmer, right? You know, everybody wants to be a farmer. Nobody wants to actually do the work. So that work, that, you know, that greenhorn in their first year, even if it's a gardener, I think these systems are the easiest way to help restore economic development and wealth building and health in communities. And, you know, let's just remember, we're in Oregon, the largest amount of unfed, poverty-stricken people are white people in this state. So this food system conversion and transformation will not only help communities of color, but it will help people who don't have any money and are hitting public health numbers that look like Mississippi and Alabama up here. So with that, I think these programs tied to STEAM, that we are an ag state, we're an ag region, we produce food, there's these economy around this. So hiring youth with the Summer Youth Employment Program, hiring apprentices in urban spaces to do work, like with organizations that are attempting.
Well, it looks like we lost Edward again, but I know what he was going to say. He was going to say hire more youth to do this work. I know that it's very important to him. We've had a conversation about this, and I know that Edward is doing some interesting things around food justice, and I hope to hear more about what he is going to launch soon. But, Lanny, I want to go back to you. You said that at Selwood we could learn to do some food preservation so at home we don't have so much waste. So tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. In the months of July and August, since I am a chef and I teach lots of canning and preserving, we do a free workshop at the Moreland Farmers Market, which is every Wednesday, 2 to 7. May through October, but in July and August specifically, we run a couple different workshops where you can come and spend 2 hours there, learn to can produce, get a discount from farmers that day if you want to buy in bulk to can your own. But we're usually trying to sort of do things that a lot of people already have in their garden, lots of extra zucchini, lots of extra cucumbers, berries that they've maybe frozen over time or whatever, and really teach people to do it and empower them to preserve their own food. And even if they do it one jar at a time, if you're going to spend money on berries and then you're going to go home and eat those berries and then you're going to find out that you only have 2 cups left, I'm going to teach you how to turn that into a jam. And then in December, you can go ahead and use that same food that you bought in the summer. It's not just important to choose, vote with your dollar, but it's also important to make sure that we are personally not wasting, because we don't know what the next step is. We don't know how to dry it. We don't know how to freeze it. We don't know how to turn it into jam or jelly or pickles or those kinds of things. So we make this accessible for everyone, and everyone leaves with a jar of preserves and a discount with farmers. I wanted to touch right back to something that Edward Hill was saying around, and you were saying as well, around the idea of a farmer's market that is really sort of pushed forward by the communities that it serves. And I just want to mention that Winter Farmers Mercado just wrapped up its second year, and that is a partnership with Hacienda CDC and my business, Plenty Community Food Services. And that is an all Latinx farmer's market, the only one that we know of in the state of Oregon. And so we're really, really excited about that. And that one runs November through March every year at the Portland Mercado on the corner of Southeast 72nd and Southeast Foster Road, and gives farmers a chance to sell things in the winter. We get a lot of squash. We get a lot of dried beans. We get a lot of dried peppers. We get lots of good onions. There are all kinds of things that either grow or preserve to be year-round here in our area. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was Edward was talking about cultivating farmers of color. And I just want to point out that there are a couple people doing some really good stuff in this area. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's the Beginning Urban Farmer Apprenticeship Program. BUFA is what people call it. Puts people of color forward to become farmers, and they actually work a plot of land in the middle of my neighborhood in Brentwood, Darlington, as their beginning farmer space, which is pretty cool. And then Adelante Mujeres out in the Washington County, who works with farmers who go directly into the local farmers market.
That is a great topic to end on. Unfortunately, we're going to have to probably leave it there. I want to mention Zinger Farms. Give a shout out to them, because Zinger's yes. Farm is doing the work in making sure that we have farmers for the next generation. I'm very excited about their work. We also have Mudbone Grown, which is doing some culturally specific farming in Portland in the city. And so all these folks are doing great work. There's just not enough of them. Mm-hmm. We need so much more than what we have at present. So that is our show for today. We're going to have to leave it there. Hopefully we can put some notes online, maybe a link to find out what day you can go to the farmer's market and learn about canning. So coming up next, it's Press Watch at 9 with Teresa Mitchell. So it's her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Rochelle Dixon. I've been your host for today. And our guests have been Edward Hill and Lanny Callie. Thank you so much for your time, all, and have a wonderful morning.
Thanks for having
us. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning. It's 8:58. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture. Women owned since 1981, providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud Showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com. Coming up, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Then at 10 o'clock, it's the Heather McCoy Show. Heather will talk to Laura Wagner of Deadspin.com to talk about the Raiders signing Richie Incognito, as well as the marketing partnership between the Boston Bruins and Barstool Sports. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app. Click on Donate. It's 8:59.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO May Board of Directors meeting will happen on Monday, June 3rd at 6 p.m. because of the Memorial Day holiday. The June board meeting will take place at the regular date and time, 6 p.m. on the fourth Monday of the month.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland.